Hello. How you doing, Ginny? Is that you, Ginny? You sitting here? You listening?
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
What are you doing?
I'm showing the evolution of culture.
Oh, that music really distorted through the sound thing, so I couldn't tell what you were playing.
Well, what I played, the first cut was an early immature phase of human culture. A man named Joseph Haydn, who lived in Europe during the time of the American Revolution, which we are inaugurating on a new level here today. But anyways, Mr. Haydn attempted to create some entertainment for the courts and new middle classes in Europe, and he produced what we call Symphony Number 34. Let's see, in D major. No, let's say D minor. Symphony Number 34 in D minor. Then we moved up the ladder of culture to an evolution, 200 years later, to Tyrone Davis. He was born in 1938, passed on in 2005, and he had a big hit in 1968 called Can I Change My Mind? And then we reached the pinnacle of culture, which is a impromptu, on-air, folky thing done on WBAI in New York City on December 28th on Bob Fass's show. Now, Bob Fass was the creator of Freeform Radio 50 years ago, in the early 60s. And he managed to be on the air the same time I was on December 20th, 21st, going into the beginning, my calendar day. So Bob Fass began Freeform Radio, and I completed. And we just happened to be on at the same time. And you can go to fivebodied.com, and listen to what Bob Fass created while we were creating here on December 20th, 21st, a few weeks ago. So we went from, and that was a improvisation by Jeffrey Lewis, a regular New York vagabond composer in folk clubs. He often gets to be on Bob Fass's show. So that's Jeffrey Lewis doing the pinnacle of culture with a friend of his on the piano. That's my goal, was to present the evolution of culture.
And why is it that we're starting the American Revolution over again, or taking it to a new level, or whatever you said earlier?
Yeah, we're completing it.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's fine.
It never got finished. Now, Ginny, do you have something you want to talk about immediately?
I just wanted to say Happy New Year, Bob. Happy New Year, Carolyn. Hi.
Hello. Well,
Thank you.
I got your email where you said, hey, Bob, a couple days ago, but I was just too slacked off to bother responding with an appropriate zombified Happy New Year. Though I got around to saying it, I changed it to all the best in the coming new, and I capitalize N-E-W. But you didn't get to see that. I did not respond to your salutation. So I'm glad you called in right now so we could do it verbally. All the more appropriate.
Yes.
Well, that's the first email I've had from you in a year, so I saved it in its own separate file in Microsoft. One single email.
Now, just as Ginny can't hear the music, I can't really make up what you said, Greg. I'm sorry.
What I said was that was the first email I've had from you in all of 2012, so I put it in a separate file.
What email was that?
The one where you quoted McLuhan's softback book from 1967.
Oh, yes. The dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. Probably the best explanation of tactility, contrast, and everything that Ion tries to explain about human perception. I sent that to you?
To Jenny and I.
Oh, that's a few days before the new year. That wasn't December 31st, I don't think.
No,
let me just check that.
As I said, I've put it in its own file. in my book. Well,
yeah, you should save that quote. Let me just check my inventory here. I scan back here and see what the last email to you was. See, I'm going way down, December 24th. Well, I'm going to do this alphabetically. It's not working that quickly. So we go to G-R-E-G-G, and we come up with September, October, November 2012, December. Gee, they're not in order. Oh, you have a new one, maybe. Okay, so very odd.
We are memorizing McLuhan. We're testing each other on our memory of that phrase, and we really did tear it apart. I actually want to do a little etymological on it and just look at each word separately and then get back to you on it. So it's there. It's on my list of things to dissect.
Okay, good, because I'm scanning through my sent file, alphabetical, you know, G comes after F and before H, and doesn't show anything in late November. It just have to find the latest. It's amazing. It's not in alphabetical order. There's so many variations of your email. I got a November 22nd. Well, maybe it's under Virginia's name. Maybe it goes first to her.
Yeah, maybe that's it anyways.
Yeah.
So we're all ready to go around the sun one more time.
Hey, look, we'll be having the... that's amazing. Nothing there. I don't know what I did. You guys didn't even get an email. Anyways...
leave me some of my delusions in, would you please? I did get an email from you in 2012.
Okay. All right, so...
Okay, this will be
Here's what I intended to do, guys. I was going to do the first hour. I think you are going to find this very interesting. I've been reading along Thomas Pynchon's novel, Against the Day. It came out in 2006. And as I said to John Better from Vancouver Island weeks ago, he has already read through the whole thing. It's just uncanny how much this is about us in Irondom, and it becomes all the more obvious why Pynchon looks like me in recent photos of him. So I'm going to read some sections to show you this. This will all sound pretty familiar, either of events that are have happened or are going to happen. So we're on page 406 of the second section. There's five sections in the book. And first section is The Light Over the Ranges. That goes 118 pages. Then the next section is called Iceland Spar. It goes from page 119 to 428. So we're near the end of section two, called Iceland Spar, with this subsection number, the 30th subsection, page 406. So these Boy Scout kind of guys, they're called the Chums of Chance. They're an extension of some hierarchy, some mysterious secret grouping that they work for. They've never met them, and they end up taking one of those balloons to various places all over the world. And this is in 1903. So they end up at what's called the now famous yearly Candlebrow conferences. So the now famous yearly Candlebrow conferences, like the institution itself, Candlebrow University, these were subsidized out of the vast fortune of Mr. Gideon Candlebrow of Grossdale, Illinois, who had made his bundle back during the great RNA drop scandal of the 80s, in which, that'd be 1880s, it says the great large scandal, but you will see it becomes RNA drops as we read more. You'll see why that's really what it's referring to. So during the great lard scandal of the 1880s, in which before Congress put an end to the practice, countless adulterated tons of that comestible were exported to Great Britain, compromising further an already debased national cuisine in Britain, giving rise throughout the island, for example, to a Christmas pudding controversy over which to this day families remain divided, often violently so. In the consequent scramble to develop more legal sources of profit, one of Mr. Canderbrow's laboratory hands happened to invent smegmo. But we're going to call it RNA drops. Happened to invent smegmo, or RNA drops, an artificial substitute for everything in the edible fat category, including margarine, which many felt wasn't that real to begin with. An eminent rabbi of World Hog Capital, Cincinnati, Ohio, was moved to declare the product kosher, adding that, quote, the Hebrew people have been waiting 4,000 years for this. RNA drops is the messiah of kitchen fats, unquote. With astonishing rapidity, RNA drops had come to account for the majority of Candlebrow Ventures' annual profits. The secret of its formula was guarded with a ruthlessness that would have embarrassed the Tsar of Russia. So at Candlebrow University, ubiquitous as the product was in the cuisine and among the table condiments of the student cafeteria at the university, you kept hearing different stories about exactly what was in it. Profits flowing from sales of RNA drops provided funding on a scale almost describable as lavish for the first international conference on time travel, a topic suddenly respectable owing to the success of Mr. H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine, first published in 1895, a year often cited as a lower limit to the date of this first conference on time travel. Although no one had yet agreed on how to assign ordinal numbers to any of the gatherings, quote, because once time travel is invented, you see, unquote, declared Professor Haino Vanderjuice, who the boys were delighted to discover was attending this year's guest lecturer. He said, quote, there's nothing to keep us from going as far back as we like and holding the conferences then, even back when this was all here, dinosaurs, giant ferns, flammivomous peaks everywhere sort of thing. Then Mr. Lindsay Noseworth protested, all due respect to the professor, but is this what we have to look forward to around here, these sophomoric slogs through endless quagmires of the metaphysical? Frankly, I don't know how much of that I can tolerate. Then Darby, leeringly, one of the chums of chance, said, a lot of nice college nookie around, though. And then Lindsay, the Puritan of the chums of chance, says, another of your vulgarism, suckling, Darby suckling, with which I must confess myself, no doubt, mercifully unfamiliar. Then Mr. Miles Blundell, another chum of chance, says, an ignorance likely to continue until the year 1925 or thereabouts. That'd be about 20 years down the way. So then Lindsay responds louder than necessary, you see, it's beginning. I imagine, naively it seems, that we'd come here to discover, if we could, some purpose to these ever more dangerous expeditions out upon which we are ordered, our unreflective participation in which someday must surely, unless we begin to take steps to promote our safety, end in our dissolution. Randolph St. Cosmo, the leader of the group, reminded them, assuming that this Dr. Zoot hasn't sent us here on a fool's errand from not entirely respectable motives of his own, darn lunatic, Darby scowled. Now, here's where we move forward and describing the pavilion. Now, think of this as maybe a place where Iandom happens. It says, inside the campus athletic pavilion, a vast dormitory space had been created, aisled and numbered, accessible by way of complicated registering procedures and color-coded tickets of identification. After lights out, a space no longer entirely readable, forested with shadows, full of whispering, murmuring, glowing white lamp mantles by bedsides, ukuleles playing and singing in the dark. Soft-voiced pages recruited from among the children of the town circulated among the sweepers all through the night watches, with telegraphic messages from parents, sweethearts, time travel societies, and other towns. Meals were served throughout the day and night, according to a mysterious timetable and system of menu changes in the dining hall of the enormous student commons, reached not by way of the ceremony entrance lobby and front desk, but by a semi-secret flight of stairs deep in the back regions, softly carpeted conduits which led ever downward to the serving line, where impatient mess staff allowed latecomers very little slack in following the correct sequence of doors and hallways, resulting at best in a stray flapjack or the dregs of a coffee urn, and as a penalty for arriving too late, a flexible concept around here? Nothing at all. Now, Jeannie, the reason this kind of stuff is happening is that this conference does not believe in time. Still with me, Jeannie?
I'm totally with you, Bob. I'm getting it. Yeah, they don't believe in time, so they're portaling in and out or going all kinds of different ways, and so the whole thing seems very mysterious. Yep, I'm getting it.
Yeah. So the sleeping quarters are very bureaucratic. But anyways, just jumping ahead, they had to go look at a time machine. So they were looking for this particular machine. They called it Walloping Wellsianism, H.G. Wells. It says, later that morning, together with Professor Vandejuice, they piled into a motor car to pay a visit to the municipal dump at the edge of town, gray with perpetual smoke, its limits undefined. Walloping Wellsianism, cried the professor. It's just a whole junkyard full. Up and down the steeply pitched sides of a ravine lay the picked over hulks of failed time machines, chronoclipses, Asimov transeculars, Temple Morph Q98s, broken, defective, scorched by catastrophic flares of misrouted energy, corroded often beyond recognition by unintended immersion in the terrible flow, that's capital F, in the terrible flow over which they had been designed and built, so hopefully to prevail. A strewn field of conjecture, superstition, blind faith, and bad engineering, expressed in sheet aluminum, vulcanite, Heusler's alloy, bonzoline, electrum, lignum vitae, platinoid, magnesium, and Pacfon silver, much of it stripped away by scavengers over the years. Where was the safe harbor in time, capital T, their pilots might have found, so allowing their craft to avoid such ignominious fates? Although they took a careful inventory, neither Chuck nor Darby, those were two chums, was able to find, assembled or in pieces, the model of the machine in which Dr. Zoot had dispatched them into that apocalyptic sweep of masses which still troubled their moments of reverie. So, as the years had gone by, Earth making its automorphic way around the sun again and yet again, the Candlebrow conferences themselves had converged to a form of eternal return. No one, for example, was ever seen to age. Now, here's where we get to the end of them. At these conferences, no one was ever seen to age. Those who, each intervening year, might have, in some technical sense, died outside the precincts of this enchanted campus, once having drifted back through the gates, were promptly resurrected once they returned to the university. Sometimes they brought their obituary clippings with them to share chucklingly with colleagues. These were solid bodily returns, mind you, nothing figurative or plasmic about them. Even to suggest that possibility had been known to fetch more than one skeptic a sock and a kisser, I'll say it again, even to suggest that possibility that it was figurative or plasmic had been known to fetch more than one skeptic a sock and a kisser for its imputations of frailty and unmanliness. The advantages to this genial revenants were apparent to all, chief among them the pleasures of ignoring medical advice, indulging in strong drink and life-threateningly fatty foodstuffs, staying out after hours in the company of the loose and demonstrably criminal, gaining on the scale and at odds whose longitude might have produced apoplexy even in much younger and fitter specimens of time scholar. And all of these diversions and more happened to be available in profusion down along the river on Lower Sim Street and the alleyways adjoining, where the desperate men resorted, where heads were cracked routinely by the stiff-headed security of the night, while only yards away flowed the river, tidied as the inside of an office, the wooden traffic rocking at ease on its gas-lit breast. They had gaslight back then. Some Candlebrow conferees had claimed to see in this a parable for that otherworldly flow, insulated from secular ills, which we know as the, capital R, River of Time. So what do you think of that, Jeannie? This is what happens when there's no time. You can ignore medical advice, indulge in strong drink and life-threateningly fatty foodstuffs, stay out after hours in the company of the loose and demonstrably criminal, game on a scale and odds whose longitude might have produced apoplexy. What do you think of that, Jeannie?
It sounds all like my life, Bob. I think we're pretty much on track for that whole thing.
Yeah,
sounds,
okay, good.
Pretty
good.
Accurate.
All right. Now, let's go back to another part where Pynchon, Thomas Pynchon, the author, is describing an out-of-body experience. which was instigated by a herb or something called Hikuli, H-I-K-U-L-I. Here's how it's described. Now, the character Frank is going to have this experience is led by a Indian woman, an American Indian woman, on the journey. So here's what happens. So he takes the Hikuli and then says, it didn't kick in for a while, but when it did, Frank was taken out of himself, not just out of his body by way of some spectacular vomiting, but out of whatever else he thought he was, out of his mind, his country and family, out of his soul. At some point, he found himself in the air, hand in hand with young Estrella, that's the Indian, flying quite swiftly at low altitude over the starlit country, her hair streaming straight out behind her. Frank, who had never flown before, kept wanting to turn right or left and go explore arroyos filled with a liquid, quivering darkness, and tall cactuses and dramas of predatory pursuit, and so forth, that now and then seemed also to be glowing in these peculiar colors. But the girl, who had flown often, knew where they had to go, and he understood after a while that she was guiding him, so relaxed and flew along with her. Later on the ground, in fact, strangely, under the ground, he found himself wandering a stone labyrinth. So he's gone underground now, he thinks. He found himself wandering a stone labyrinth from one cave to another, oppressed by a growing sense of danger. Each time he chose a branch, thinking it would lead him out to open air, it only took him deeper, and soon he was at the edge of panic. The girl said to him, "Do not," carefully palming him somehow with an inexplicable clarity of touch, "do not be afraid. They want you to be afraid, but you do not have to give them what they want. You have the power not to be afraid. Find it, and when you do, try to remember where it is," unquote. While continuing to be the Tarahumare girl, Estrella, so while she was this Indian girl, the particular tribe, Tarahumares, she had also at the same time become Estrella Briggs, who is an old girlfriend of Frank's. They came to a cave in which it was raining, calmly but steadily. Inside this one cave, she explained, falling steadily for thousands of years, was all the rain that should have been falling on the southwestern desert, vaporous and gray, not from any spring within the mountain or from clouds outside directly overhead, but as a result of the original sin, crime, or mistake that had produced the desert itself. See, so they find this little cave where it never stops raining, and it's been raining all the time there instead of on the desert. "Think not, Frank," he goes, "think not," Frank objected. "The desert is something that has evolved over geological time, not somebody's personal punishment." And she says, "Back before the beginning of all that, when they were designing the world," Frank goes, "they?" She says, "they. The idea was that water should be everywhere, free to everybody. It was life. Then a few got greedy." End of quote there, and then she says, and the narrator says, Estrella went on to tell Frank how the desert was made to serve as their penance, because they got greedy. And so to balance it somewhere, hidden in the uncounted miles of wasteland, will be this one cave, dense with water forever falling. If anyone wanted to search for it, why, of course, they were welcome, though the odds were they'd wander forever without finding it. Tales you heard of haunted silver and gold mines half the time are really about this one hidden cave of rainwater, precious beyond price. But the old desert mad folk believed they had to tell it in a kind of code that others would be listening, that saying anything out loud would cause the place to grow that much more remote, dangerous to approach. So that was explained to Frank. At no point in this did Frank think he was dreaming, probably because he seldom remembered dreams or paid attention to them even if he did. And though this all had the alert immediacy of daytime Mexico in its ongoing dispute with his history, it would someday be relegated as well to the register of experiences he had been unable to find any use for. So they returned to the desert camp among whirling colors, including magenta, low brilliancy turquoise, and a peculiarly pale wriggling violet, appearing not only around contours, but smudged and bleeding inside them as well. Affording glimpses now and then of some solitary band of figures alone on the prairie toward sunset, the untouched depths of the wind sweeping away for hundreds of miles of air, even of this purity, beginning in this last light from its own glaciating thickness to blur the distant mountains toward a sketchwork suggestive of other worlds, mythic cities at the horizon. So, that was his trip. How are we doing, Jenny? Any responses so far?
Well, as I'm listening to you read all this, Bob, I am focused on the whole premise of this is that there is no time and that these are the different experiences of these people and going in and out of all these things. So I would just say I'm reflecting on my own recent experience in the last month or so of becoming very aware of the fact that there is no time. And
very good.
That's what I'm thinking about.
And now, is that what, in all the work you're putting in to make the free radio ion, or radio-free ion, all the time at the chip body, is that it bring in the no-time factor, since you got your head buried in the computer so much?
No, not that as much as even, we took a little bit of time and went on a trip and had the holidays and just have been in a really kind of, it's literally like sands through an hourglass and you just have experience passing through you, but you're not really registering time. So it's a very different kind of, experience of living.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. Now, they find this machine they're looking for, the Chums of Chance, and here's a description of what happens when they enter this particular time machine. Let's see. The two boys squinted at where the quartz translucency had been, trying to make out what was happening. A kind of vibration, less from the physical chamber itself than from somewhere unsuspected within their own nervous organizations, now began to strengthen in intensity. They seemed to be in the midst of some great storm in whose low illumination presently they could make out in unremitting sweep across the field of vision, inclined at the same angle as the rain, if rain it was, some material descent, gray and wind stress, undoubted human identities. So they could make out undoubted human identities, masses of souls mounted, pillioned, on foot, ranging along together by the millions over the landscape, accompanied by a comparably unmeasurable herd of horses. The multitude extended farther than they could see, a spectral cavalry, faces disquietingly wanting in detail, eyes little more than blurred sockets, the draping of garments constantly changing in an invisible flow which perhaps was only wind. Bright arrays of metallic points hung and drifted in three dimensions and perhaps more, like stars blown through by the shockwaves of the creation. C, capital C, creation. Were those voices out there crying in pain? Sometimes it almost sounded like singing. Sometimes a word or two in a language almost recognizable came through. Thus, galloping and unceasing flow ever ahead, denied any further control over their fate, the disconsolate company, meaning these two guys, were borne terribly over the edge of the visible world. The chamber shook as in a hurricane. Ozone permeated its interior like the musk attending some mating dance of automata, and the boys found themselves more and more disoriented. Soon even the cylindrical confines they had entered seemed to have fallen away, leaving them in a space unbounded in all directions. Now, there's McLuhan's acoustic space. There became audible a continuous roar as of the ocean, but it was not the ocean, and soon cries as of beasts in open country, verily purring stridencies passing overhead, sometimes too close for the lads to be altogether comfortable with. But they were not beasts. Everywhere rose the smell of excrement and dead tissue. Each lad was looking intently through the darkness at the other, as if about to inquire when it would be considered proper to start screaming for help. But Chick, one of the boys, said, "If this is our host's idea of the future..." But he was abruptly checked by the emergence from the ominous sweep of shadow surrounding them of a long pole with a great metal hook on the end, of the sort commonly used to remove objectionable performers from the variety stage, which, being latched firmly about Chick's neck, had in the next instant pulled them off into regions indecipherable. Before Darby, his buddy, had time to shout after, the hook reappeared to perform a similar extraction on him, and quick as that, both youngsters found themselves back in the laboratory of Dr. Zoot. The fiendish time machine, still in one piece, quivered in its accustomed place as if with merriment. And Carolyn giggles. What do you think of that? Greg or Ginny.
That's pretty cool. I like when they were hanging over the side of the world. That's neat.
Yeah. There's more things to say, to read. Let's see what we've got. We've got some messages here. Are you looking at the message board, Ginny?
No, I'm not, Bob. I don't have my computer open.
The Great Gazoo, he writes very quickly to begin the show, Happy New Year, Bob. Have you spoken with Mr. Buzz Kostin? He has started to mash the payday. It's a great buzz. No, I haven't. I have not spoken with Mr. Kostin. We had an email exchange where we insulted each other, but that was around the playing on the December 18th show and the December 20th. I was playing excerpts from the McLuhan on Maui conference number 3, where Ion invaded Buzz Kostin's serenity. I drew his attention to that, and that led to a all-out war between me and Buzz. So I have not known that he was going to do anything with payday, Mr. Gazoo. I'm addressing Mr. Gazoo. Now we go to Robert of Tottenham, who's always counted on to be attending the show and communicating in some form or medium. He has chosen in quick message today, and let's see what he says. Hi, Bob. Great readings at payday. What the hell is he talking about? What I'm reading now, I guess? He's commenting on the readings halfway through them.
Yeah, you didn't stumble once.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Great readings at payday. I'm in charge. Well done, Ginny and everyone. We can always count on Robert to keep people's spirits up, that there's nothing to be done and everybody's doing a good job, because Robert said, well done, Ginny. And I guess you
very
too,
good.
Greg, if you're still here. Now, Mike in Utah, who actually wrote an email to me, which I answered earlier today. Maybe we'll read some of that. He's a new boy, and he's wondering how the revolution is going and how he can be part of it. And so he says from Utah, Bob, what's the name of the book again? The book is called Against the Day. That's A-G-A-I-N-S-T, second word, T-H-E, the article. The third word is day, D-A-Y. Against the Day by Thomas Pynchon, that's P-Y-N-C-H-O-N, perhaps the greatest novelist of the last 30 years, especially since his books are apparently describing Iondom more and more. Let's see. He then says, and can you just get into how it relates to the Iondom world rather than read to it? No. You're not going to have the meaning before the experience. You're going to have the experience and then the meaning. These people want the explanation. That's what happens in a world of instant replay, Ginny. Everybody reads the critical notices before the experience. They have the meaning before the experience. This is one of the great disservices of the instant replay.
So, that is correct, and that's what Marshall McLuhan said in 1965, and I agree completely with him.
What did he say in 1965?
That this service and service of the instant replay, pointing out all the foibles of it. And I agree
completely. No, he didn't. He did not say that. The instant replay didn't show up till 1970. He did say that rather quickly after 1970, and he often told the story. He was never off duty. He would, because of his fame, meet other famous people on talk shows. So he met some famous football player, and he took advantage in the green room to ask the football player what was the effect of the instant replay on his game. And the famous quarterback proceeded to inventory all kinds of strange effects. And so that's how Marshall did his research, just by talking to people and having the advantage to meet people who were experiencing the effects of instant replay, because it was the most effective in the world of football. And that's why Monday Night Football took over in 1970 and wrecked so many homes over the next 30 or 40 years, because of the appeal of the instant replay. So Marshall commented on it in 71, 72, 73, not 1965, Ginny. That's unless you're operating in a non-time zone, that's the only way we'd accept that.
Yes, I'm strapped into my time machine, Bob, and I'm just floating through the McLuhan Library, picking out little comments. And even, I think that he had the thought about it in 1965, but it didn't really show up until the 70s.
Yes, it could be, because metaphor was all media are instant replay. Speech is instant replay. It gathers experience and then replays it and stores it. So the role of metaphor itself is in this replay. So that is why I began my book. The first quote from the McLuhan section was the explanation of the instant replay as metaphor, because that is the be-all and end-all of experience, the metaphor. What's the metaphor? What's the matter for you? So anyways, Mike goes on to say, sorry if I'm stepping on your gig, but hoping you'll tie it all in together. Yeah, we'll tie it all in together eventually. Not immediately. We need to process some data first. Okay, Wendy from Calgary says, hi, Bob. Really enjoyed your opening songs. Now there's the spirit. There's someone experiencing the show. You know what I mean? And commenting on what she's experiencing. And she says, I'm glad Ginny is on the show tonight, as I want to give her a huge thank you for Radio Free Ion. Well, there you go, Ginny.
Aw, you're welcome. Yay!
I suggest in 2014 you stop saying, yay! It's silly, Ginny. It's not congenial or conducive.
No. I endorse
Carol
yay.
Kennedy.
I endorse yay.
See how nuts she's becoming?
No.
Ginny? Carolyn, she thinks that it's beneficial.
It is. I think it's fabulous.
Don't step on my gig.
Okay.
So,
yay!
But that, do it like that. Yay! Some kind of like some animal, a Monty Python or something. Not this. Yay! That's too human. They get less anthropomorphic.
Yay!
So the great Gazoo replies, hey, Bob, what's going to happen in 2013? Any predictions? Well, first of all, it's not going to be called 2013. It's going to be 2014, if I had any say in the matter, because it is 2014 now. It's unfolding. We are in 2014, calendrically speaking. Greg, do you have anything, or have you gone away?
Greg, yes, he does have something, but I accidentally hung up on him, so he's going to have to call me back. But I just want to comment, yes, that anybody with the basic ion, thing going on like the Great Gazoo should definitely know that we are in 2014, and we were in 2013 all last year.
Yes, and all the changes they were hoping for a few weeks ago happened in 2011. See, that's why.
Right, with the blood moon and the release of the four winds. Yeah,
yes,
I agree.
And the isotopes, H-197, it was a disastrous year in 2011 for most people. They haven't even noticed it, most of them yet. But don't think you escaped the end of the Mayan calendar. You are still waking up to what happened now a couple of years ago. And you can rest assured that I was a major linchpin in that disaster. And if you
were
stay
a
with
major linchpin in the Mayan calendar disaster.
Yes. The 2011 cataclysmic events would not have happened unless I had organized with Brian the rewrite group. The rewrite group triggered all that bad news and tough stuff for the little woman and the little women. It wasn't for the small, tiny bands, the chums of chance, so we call ourselves. Sorry, I was just going to say just a minute, but I sneezed through the just a minute. And that's the kind of stuff that Connie likes. He had a raucous, Three Stooges kind of sense of humor.
Yeah, slapstick. Bob's a real slapstick artist.
Yeah. So we're coming down to the last 52 seconds in the first hour. And yes, Wendy, a lot more fantastic music is going to come. And we were hoping to play Gustav Mahler's symphony number 34, but we clicked on it, it didn't work. So Bill saved the day and told me to go to the next one and click on it. And that's how we get to Haydn. Maybe we'll get to Mr. Mahler, but there's lots of other stuff we're playing here. And we'll get to the purpose of this show, at some point down the wire. I hope you can all stay. Ginny, hope you can stay. No time, so you actually have to stay the whole show. Get it?
Nice one, Bob.
Yeah,
nice,
nice
way
one.
To just slip a little Mickey in my drink. Well,
here we go. We're having a little outro. I forgot to tell Bill which one to play, so let's see what he picked.